Today is Thursday, December 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump continues challenging the results of the 2020 election.
The Republican demands the 62 electoral college votes in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin be invalidated.
Plus, on the ground in Sudan with Tigrayan refugees.
Mothers here say they tried to cover their children's eyes as they fled. But some, as young as 4 years old, still asked, who killed these people?
And a controversial film is set to debut. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump says that his campaign will join an improbable case before the Supreme Court challenging election results in Pennsylvania and other states he lost. AP correspondent Ben Thomas starts us off.
This is the big one. That's what President Trump says in a tweet, referring to a lawsuit filed by Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. The Republican demands the 62 electoral college votes in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin be invalidated, repeating a litany of false, disproven, and unsupported allegations about mail-in ballots and voting in the four states. Legal experts dismiss Paxton's filing. It's the latest and perhaps longest legal shot since Election Day, and officials in the four states are sharply critical. Yesterday, the Supreme Court rejected a bid to reverse Pennsylvania's certification of Joe Biden's victory. Ben Thomas, Washington.
President Trump has lost several post-election lawsuits aimed at overturning President-elect Joe Biden's victory. As the president's legal challenges fail in court, December 8th has come and gone, marking the safe harbor deadline where states finalize certification of their election results, further limiting Trump's ability to contest them. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikaswara takes it from here.
In the 5 weeks since the November 3rd election, there have been celebrations.
USA! USA!
Protests.
It's a fraud. It's been stolen. Yes. It's been stolen. It was rigged.
And several state recounts and dozens of legal challenges over the election. And none of it has changed the result. Joe Biden won the 2020 election. But President Donald Trump is not ready to concede.
We've never lost an election. We're winning this election.
Aziz Haque is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago.
The closing of the safe harbor is merely another nail on the coffin of the president's efforts to overturn the due result of the election in court through false claims of voter fraud.
Results finalized by the safe harbor date are considered to be conclusive by Congress. All states have certified except for Wisconsin, expected to certify later this week. John Fortier is the director for governmental studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
But if an election were certified after December 8th and electors were selected, as long as they were selected by the December 14th, when they actually cast their votes, Congress certainly could count those votes when they count the votes in January.
The president has mounted dozens of legal challenges in seven states where he lost: Arizona, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Nevada. He has won one lawsuit and lost more than 40, with several unresolved in Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. The Supreme Court on Tuesday denied an appeal of a lower court ruling against a lawsuit seeking to overturn Pennsylvania's vote. As his legal team failed in courts, Trump's Attorney General Bill Barr also said there was no evidence of widespread fraud. But Trump supporters continue to threaten election officials, causing one of them, a Republican, to push back. Gabriel Sterling is the voting implementation manager in the state of Georgia.
It has to stop. Mr. President, you have not condemned these actions or this language.
After losses in court, Trump has intervened by pressuring officials and legislators in Georgia, Michigan, and Pennsylvania to overturn the election results. Although these attempts failed, they expose vulnerabilities in the American electoral system. Aziz Haque from the University of Chicago.
Only time will tell whether what comes out of this election is a renewed commitment to the integrity of the electoral system, particularly at the level of the states, or what we've learned is how fragile our election system is, how close we've come to a really dangerous outcome.
On December 14th, the 538 people designated as the United States Electoral College will meet in cities across the country to formally cast ballots for president and vice president. Patsy Vidakuswara, VOA News.
French legislators are considering a controversial law clamping down on religious organizations to fight what some call Islamic separatism, but many French Muslims say the rules unfairly target them. For more insight, International Edition's Jason Patinkin spoke to journalist Catherine Field in Paris.
It's all about making sure that no religious group or no faith group sets up parallel structures to those which are provided by the state. That means schools, health services, housing must only be done by the state. And in particular, they are concerned that too many radical strands of some religions and some faiths have set up their own schools, have set up health centers, as well as nurseries. And because of that, they are not subject to the same rigorous controls that the state has, such as inspectors for schools, inspectors for health services, and various facilities that are there and are there and available to everyone.
And so why is the government looking to do this?
On the one hand, you had the government, which saw that in around 15 different districts in France provided just about all of the young Muslims who went out to Syria, went out to the Middle East to fight with the so-called Islamic State. So they went into those 15 districts and actually had a look at what was happening on the ground. Yes, France does have a rather large Muslim population by percentage. It is the largest in Western Europe. It's around 6% of the population. And the interesting thing is that it's a very young population now. The population is a very young, much younger and much more vocal than, say, in the Catholic faith. So you've got far more young Muslim, mostly boys, who are far more vocal, who are far more able to stand up and say, we want to be treated the same as everyone else. So in lots of ways, the French state is having to react to this far more assertive group of young Muslims that feel that they are being targeted quite unfairly.
So how does that then relate to this issue of, you know, schools or, you know, religious schools or religious health clinics or other religious institutions?
The young Muslims, particularly the ones in these 15 districts, they say that when they do go to school, they don't get the same advantages as some of the other pupils. They say they're targeted. They say that they really just are not being given the same opportunities to move up within the education system. And then once they do get to a particular point in the education system, that they're disadvantaged for education places, for example, in universities. But some of the other issues in particular that the Prime Minister and Minister of Education are looking at is indeed these clandestine schools, and particularly the nursery schools, kindergartens and primary schools. There is a fear that there are too many of these and that what they're doing is keeping children away from the state system, so that not only are you away from the state system, these clandestine schools are not teaching the national curriculum, and they're also dividing boys and girls, which doesn't happen in French schools, and that makes it more difficult for those children, particularly the girls, to be able to, if you like, move into the state education system once they get older, because essentially they're lost in the underground.
You know, France has long presented itself as a secular state where there is separation of religion and government. So what about this is new?
There's not that much that's new. It's more that the government is reacting to some of the more clandestine ways that the more radical elements of some religions have been using the space that is not being taken up by the state.
That was reporter Catherine Field speaking to my colleague Jason Patinkin. FireEye, one of the largest cybersecurity companies in the United States, said on Tuesday that it had been hacked, likely by a government, leading to the theft of an arsenal of internal hacking tools typically reserved to privately test the cyber defenses of its clients. I discussed the significance of the incursion with John Heslin, a political science professor at Augusta University's Cyber Institute.
You know, I think it's fairly significant. I don't think it's just the most earth-shattering thing, because I think that everybody will sort of understand what happened. And I see where FireEye released the some of the tools they were using, just so people could take the proper precautions. But I think it's a little bit concerning, but for the short term, but sort of medium term, long term, I think the sort of the powers that be in the the IT companies that are producing code and stuff, they'll be able to sort of shore everything up.
One question I do have, if we take a look at some of the more famous security breaches over the past few years, what immediately comes to my mind is the Swift banking hack, the Sony Pictures hack, some of the attacks in South Korea on the banking and infrastructure systems there. Now that you have a state actor that the FBI is saying possibly went in for the FireEye tools, do you foresee an escalation in the behavior of bad actors in the cybersecurity sector moving forward, more brazen attacks, more devastating attacks?
I would say yes. Overall, yes, you're going to see like an evolution to more sophisticated attacks as states like North Korea and Iran, sort of gain more, sort of capability and know-how. So, even states like, very sophisticated states like, Russia and China, they're going to be very careful about what tools they use. They don't want to sort of give away the keys to the kingdom. So they may not use the most sophisticated tools to sort of do what they did with FireEye.
One last question. We're talking about this incursion against FireEye. They are a very well-developed cybersecurity firm. There have been other hacks on equally powerful entities around the world. But what about countries and individuals who do not have as robust of a cybersecurity defense? Is there any takeaways that you've gleaned from looking at this and from elsewhere that might better help them?
I would say, one of the big things they could do, honestly, is kind of go the route that the Department of Defense did back in 2008 when they banned the use of thumb drives. That was after a pretty nasty breach that came into DoD systems from the Middle East, and they think through thumb drives. It's just the easiest way. I mean, I sort of cringe now when I see people taking out thumb drives, passing them around, putting in computers, because if you think about it, if there's sort of a if you're a big organization and you have some type of proprietary data you don't want to you don't want to sort of get out to your competitors, that's hidden in your computer systems, and everybody's sort of passing around thumb drives. It's really not hard for somebody to sort of seed an area with thumb drives. Sooner or later, one's going to be put into a computer.
That was Professor John Heslin from the Cyber Institute at Augusta University in Georgia. Refugees fleeing Ethiopia often don't know if the children, parents, or siblings they left behind in the chaos of fleeing a war are alive or dead when they arrive at remote camps in Sudan. VOA's Heather Murdoch is on the scene.
This camp now houses many of the more than 46,000 refugees who recently fled war in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Hundreds more are arriving every day, despite border closings inside the conflict zone. Mothers here say they tried to cover their children's eyes as they fled, but some as young as 4 years old still asked, who killed these people, when they saw slaughtered bodies strewn on the streets. Families here tell a gruesomely similar story. This is Hawa Tesfe, a mother of four who recently fled Ethiopia. She says she has seen horrible things before, but never the brutality of recent weeks. The conflict began in November, and it is unknown how many people are dead, wounded, or missing, as the Ethiopian central government and local forces battle for control of the Tigray region. But there is a lot currently unknown about civilians still inside the war zone, as they are largely cut off from aid workers and journalists. Reports say a huge amount of people there are in desperate need of immediate help, and tensions on the ground are growing. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Umm Rakuba Camp, Sudan.
The negotiation teams of the Afghan government and Taliban have agreed to refer differences in interpretation of Sharia law to a joint committee, protect the confidentiality of negotiations, and carry out the process with truthfulness, sincerity, and determination, according to the code of conduct agreed to both sides last week. The preamble of the code sets up four fundamentals as the basis of negotiations. The first of which is the agreement signed February 29, 2020 between the United States and the Taliban. The Afghan government was not party to that deal, and the government negotiations team strongly resisted its inclusion, according to sources familiar with the talks. The rest of the document defines how the two sides would behave during the negotiation process and what issues could or could not become part of the agenda. The United States Agency for Global Media has named writer and diplomat Robert Riley as the new director of Voice of America, a position he held from 2001 to 2002. In an email to agency staff on Wednesday, USAGM CEO Michael Pack said Riley's VOA experience and leadership will be a benefit to the agency. Riley was quoted in the email saying, "I have always been a firm adherent of VOA's mission of telling America's story to the world." Riley is director of the Westminster Institute, a research organization set up in 2009 to promote freedom with a focus on threats from extremist ideology. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, gave a news conference on the eve of Human Rights Day, speaking on her reflections about 2020 and looking ahead to 2021. She focused on the need to recover better and to stand up for human rights. Lisa Schlein reports.
The coronavirus has wrecked the lives and livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people. Globally, the pandemic has infected at least 68 million people and killed more than 1.5 million, according to the Johns Hopkins University. Safe and effective vaccines are on the horizon, providing hope that the pandemic soon will be consigned to the history books. But UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says a medical vaccine will not prevent or cure the socioeconomic ravages caused by the pandemic. She says the only thing that can accomplish that is what she calls the vaccine of human rights. Its core ingredients, she says, are embedded in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, celebrated on Human Rights Day. The Declaration contains important international treaties that protect the rights of specific groups, including children, women, the disabled, and migrant workers. Unfortunately, Bachelet says, the failure of many countries to take the coronavirus seriously and to act quickly enough to prevent its spread has eroded these rights and protections.
Astoundingly, even to this day, some political leaders are still playing down its impact, disparaging the use of simple measures such as wearing masks and avoiding large gatherings. Politicizing a pandemic in this way is beyond irresponsible. It is utterly reprehensible. Scientific evidence and process have been discounted, and conspiracy theories and disinformation have been sown and allowed or encouraged to thrive.
Bachelet says these actions have damaged trust between nations and within nations. She says this has allowed discrimination, systemic racism, and marginalization of the most vulnerable people in the world to flourish.
In countries in conflict, COVID had added an additional layer to already multifaceted human rights calamities. In Yemen, a perfect storm of 5 years of conflict and violations, disease, blockades, and shortage of humanitarian funding set against an existing backdrop of poverty, poor governance, and lack of development is pushing the country remorselessly towards full-scale famine.
Bachelet says the pandemic has left the world exposed, vulnerable, and weakened. But she says governments can turn this situation around if they have the political will to put the right policies in place. Bachelet says leaders in powerful countries must recognize that global challenges can be met only through global cooperation. She notes no one is safe until everyone is safe. She says governments must put their narrow nationalistic responses aside for the good of all. The first test of this, she says, will be their willingness to ensure new COVID vaccines and tools reach everyone who needs them, poor and rich alike. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The main Arar border crossing between Saudi Arabia and Iraq reopened last month after a 30-year closure dating back to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Observers consider it the biggest step toward normalization of relations since the 2003 ouster of Saddam Hussein. Saudi Arabia has been very reluctant to accept a Shiite-led government in Iraq, but observers say that both countries are seeing changing realities in the region and recognize the need to move forward. Dale Gavlak has more.
Middle East observers say the rapprochement between the two oil giants has been years in the making. Saudi Arabia wants to counter the growing political and military influence of its rival Iran in Iraq and the region, while Iraq needs Saudi investments to help provide jobs for its numerous unemployed youths and recover from years of devastating sectarian conflict. Bruce Rydell, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy in Washington, says a new U.S. administration will likely engage Iran in a bid to curb its nuclear ambitions that has spurred Saudi Arabia to mend ties with Gulf neighbors.
Saudis have belatedly realized that isolating Iraq only pushed it into the hands of the Iranians. The current effort, which is by far the most significant by opening up the border checkpoint, reflects the Saudi awareness that counting on the patronage of the Trump administration for the last 4 years is coming to an end, facing what is likely to be a very difficult time, U.S.-Saudi relations. They're trying to reposture somewhat. One is with the Iraqis, another is with Qataris.
Other observers say the rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iraq reflects diplomatic shifts, such as recognition of Israel by the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, and warming ties between Qatar and Gulf states with Egypt. A Dubai Gulf News editorial called the Arar border opening a new milestone in the long and historic relationship between these two Arab neighbors. It heralded the latest positive development to accrue from the ongoing dialogue between Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadami. Rydell says that while improving ties is beneficial, he warns that Iran has been cultivating Iraqi Shiite and Kurdish politicians for decades.
It's helpful in that it gives Iraqi leaders some balance. But at the end of the day, Iran has enormous influence in Iraq. Saudi helped to modestly offset that, but it can't fundamentally change the fact that Iran is the leading regional player with influence in Iraqi politics.
The Arar transit is viewed as an alternative to Iraq's crossings with Iran to the east, through which it brings in huge imports. Some pro-Iranian factions in Iraq, however, oppose closer ties with Sunni Muslim stalwart Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia will also be wary of potential Shiite militant traffic from Iraq crossing inside its own border. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Even in Africa's most vibrant cinematic market, Ife stands out. The tale of love between two Nigerian women has delayed the controversial film's release, leading to a battle with the nation's censorship board. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to the producer and two African LGBTQ activists ahead of the film's December 10th online launch.
I told my mom first. Took her about it.
In the Yoruba language of Nigeria, Ife means love. But this love story between two women in a society where homosexuality is largely shunned and where same-sex marriage is illegal. The nation's censorship board threatened to go after the film's maker for promoting homosexuality in a film industry that, despite its huge output, is largely conservative. That has led the filmmakers to not push for local release. They instead plan to drop it online on December 10th.
Filmmakers here, mainstream filmmakers, usually shy away from telling stories that center LGBT people. And even when those stories are told, they are told from a very negative point of view.
More than 30 African countries criminalize non-heterosexual relationships. In 2018, Kenya's first lesbian feature film, Rafiki, was banned at home, despite the fact that it was the nation's first piece to premiere at the prestigious Cannes Film Festival.
Happiness.
So who should watch this film? U.S.-based writer and filmmaker Noni Sama, who is Nigerian and transgender, said the answer is simple. Everybody.
I think it's a huge, it's a big deal for queer people, for lesbian women, for people who are not lesbian women who, you know, just want to watch stuff that's outside, you know, the mainstream narrative, or even people who might be uncomfortable.
It's also a story of pain, says Adie, one that many members of the community can relate to.
I was pretty much rejected by my whole family, you know, especially my mom, who at some point asked me to move out of our family house. You know, and later on, she asked me to change my family name.
The same holds in South Africa, which was the first African nation to decriminalize homosexuality and allow gay marriage. Activist and storyteller Welcome Lashiva says even here, lesbians are overlooked and subjected to horrible treatment.
The story of lesbian women is no different from the story of women in general in relation to men, because we live in a deeply sexist society, a deeply patriarchal society.
So is Africa ready for this film? Adie will leave it to her characters, Ife and Adora, to answer that.
We're lesbians. This is the perfect time.
Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a tremendous Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To no one's surprise, the Cuban regime's commitment to dialogue with peaceful young demonstrators who recently gathered, hundreds strong, to protest the lack of freedom of expression in Cuba was short-lived. Less than 24 hours after a meeting between protest representatives and the Vice Minister of Culture, Fernando Rojas, the regime threw away a chance to respect the rights of the Cuban people. Rojas denounced the protesters and dismissed their concerns over censorship and police attacks on independent artists. Many of the protesters are members of the San Isidro movement, a loose collective of writers, artists, musicians, and other citizens who are outraged by the strictures continually placed upon them by the regime, including a law requiring that any artistic activity be registered with the government. More recently, the demonstrators have been protesting the summary sentencing of prominent members of the group, among them the musician Denis Solis Gonzalez, for expressing himself independently. The regime has repeatedly targeted Solis for exercising his freedom of expression by denouncing human rights abuses in Cuba and arrested him on November 9th. Cuban authorities held Solis incommunicado for 3 days before sentencing him to 8 months in prison on the dubious charge of contempt. Cuban authorities arrested dozens of journalists and human rights defenders seeking information about his case or calling for his release. Despite the harsh response by the government, protests concerning his case and the lack of free expression in Cuba continued, followed by more attacks and arrests by the police. Members of the international community have expressed objections to the repression, including Amnesty International. The U.S. State Department took a strong stand. In a written statement, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, "The United States strongly condemns the Cuban regime's harassment of activists peacefully protesting the imprisonment of human rights defender Denis Solis Gonzalez. We urge the Cuban government to dismiss this unjust sentence and release him without condition. The United States stands in solidarity with the Cuban people, and we will continue to denounce these flagrant abuses against Cubans exercising their rights," said Secretary Pompeo. "We call on democratic partners around the world to raise their voices and make respect for human rights a prerequisite for any dealing with the Castro regime."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.